how urgently they needed this case nailed shut. A kid could have seen why. It never came near my mind. Maybe Breslin really did believe McCann, when he rang out of the night with a story that was just barely plausible, and not just because he needed to be the noble white knight. Maybe he believed it because when the other possibility came into his mind, the only thing his mind could do was spit it out and leap away. Maybe not. Steve is staring blankly at the place where Breslin was. Even if we had, it would have probably made no difference. It's not like there's extra evidence we could have got our hands on. We'd be banjaxed anyway. It would have made a difference, but all the ways it would have made all the difference hang in my head, weaving together into one thick, dark curtain. I haven't got a way to put it into words. What might be gone for good behind its slow sway. What these few days might have changed if only we'd seen. I say, I'm not done. I get my phone out and I start skimming through my contacts. Steve's eyes move to me, dark and doubtful. We're not going to get him. What Breslin said, it sucks, but he's right. I know. He starts to say something else, but I lift a finger. The phone's ringing.
Louis Crowley,
says Creepy Crowley suspiciously. The background noise sounds like he's in a pub. How are you? I say. Antoinette Conway, Murder Squad. I need to talk to you, like, now. Where are you? I throw in a good pinch of suppressed desperation to get him drooling, and it works. Crowley says. I'm not sure I have the time. Come on. You won't regret it. The little prick thinks he knows exactly what's going on here, and he's going to wring every last drop out of it. Well, he says, on a sigh, loving this. I suppose. I'm in Grogan's. I'll be here for another half hour. If you get here before I leave, I can give you a few minutes. Great, I say, letting the rush of gratitude slip through. Great, I'll be there. And I hang up. Was that Crowley? Steve asks. His eyebrows are up. I need to shut him down, remember? And I've got an idea. I shove the phone in my pocket, stand up and tug the creases out of my suit. Come with me. I could do a backup. All of a sudden, there's a twitch tugging at the corner of Steve's mouth. He says, would this idea count as a glitch in the plan? I fucking well hope so. You coming or not? Steve shoves back his chair and stands up grinning. Wouldn't miss it. No one is in the corridors when we get our coats. No one is in the locker room. The familiar run of sound comes through the squad room door. Keyboards, phone calls, bitching, the printer. In the middle of it all is that smooth, power voice of Breslin, raised in some punchline that gets a big laugh. Up in Incident Room C, the floaters are working away. Busy little bees piling up paper that'll go straight down to the basement. Even reception is empty. Bernadette's on break or in the jacks. We walk out of the murder building and no one even knows we're gone. Crowley's on his own at the corner table in Grogan's, sipping a pint of Smithwick's and reading a beat-up paperback with Sartre on the cover in massive letters so everyone will get that he's on a higher plane. He pretends he doesn't notice us till we're practically on top of his table. Crowley, I say. He does a bad fake startle and puts the book down. Steve is a surprise, but Crowley covers okay. Ah, he says, holding out his hand and giving Steve a gracious smile, ignoring me, to put me in my place. Detective Moran. How are you? Steve says, without taking Crowley up on the handshake. He thumps down on a stool, long legs sprawled everywhere, pulls out his phone and gives it his full attention. I can see Crowley trying to figure this out. I sit down opposite him, prop my elbows on the table and my chin on my fingers, and smile at him. How are you? Yes, he says, with a nice mix of distaste and wariness. He's not getting the feed of desperation I promised him. Hello. Nice articles you've been running. I've never been on the front page before. I feel like Kim Kardashian. Hardly, Crowley says, eyeballing me. You liked the photo.
Crowley, I say, you're after making a bad mistake.
This isn't going the way Crowley expected, but he holds up well. After all, he's still got the upper hand, whether I behave myself or not.
Oh, I don't think so. If you don't want to look like a bully in the eyes of the nation.
Steve has fired up some game that's a mixture of beeping noises and cherry bombs. Crowley twitches, but he manages to hang on to his train of moral outrage.
Then don't try to bully the agents of free speech. It really is that simple.
Nah, nah, nah. I'm not here about the photo. My problem is a guy who saw the photo. He rang you up looking for my address, and you gave it to him?
Haven't a clue what you're talking about, Crowley says. He folds his pudgy little hands on the table and smirks at me. How is your father, by the way?
While I'm still being puzzled, Steve's head snaps up and he lets out a great big snort of laughter.
He did not, did he?
Crowley's eyes zip back and forth between us, the smirk's fading. This is why I wanted Steve along. If I was here to beg Crowley to keep my deepest family secret just between us, I wouldn't have brought company.
Who didn't do what? I demand.
And you? Where do you know my dad from?
Your man who rang you,
Steve says to Crowley.
He didn't actually tell you he was Conway's dad, did he?
Ah, for fuck's sake, I say.
Seriously?
Steve starts to laugh properly. Crowley shoots him a poisoned look.
Well, that's what he said. He said he'd lost touch a long time back and wanted to reconnect. And you fell for it, I demand. Just like that. Well, he seemed legit. I didn't see any reason to doubt him.
You're supposed to be a journalist, Steve points out, still grinning.
Doubt's supposed to be your thing.
Jesus, I say. I don't even like you, and I'm scarlet for you.
You got played, man, Steve said, shaking his head and going back to his game. Played like a pound shop kazoo.
Crowley, I say, you're a walking fucking lobotomy. The guy who rang you isn't my dad. Steve starts laughing again on that. He's a scumbag from up north who I helped put away for a few years. And when he saw that photo, it occurred to him that this was his big chance to get his own back. And you gave him my fucking home address. A lot of the air goes out of Crowley.
He's been casing my gaff ever since, I say. And last night I found him in my sitting room. You figure he was just there for the chats?
Conway, Steve says in his deepest voice, I am your father.
Luckily for everyone, I say, I sorted the situation. He's not going to be back. The only problem I've got left is you. Me and my partner, we've been trying to decide what to charge you with.
Conspiracy to commit burglary, Steve suggests, jabbing away at his phone.
And assault, depending on whether your man was only planning on leaving a chocolate log in Conway's fridge, or whether he was hoping to do very bad things to her personally.
Or accessory before the fact, or we could go for the law, just for laughs, and see what sticks.
Crowley's gone even paler and sweatier than usual. He says,
I want to talk to my solicitor.
You're in deep shite here, I tell him.
Lucky for you, though, I've got a use for you.
I'm serious. I want to talk to my solicitor right now.
Hey, genius, Steve says, zapping something with a nuke noise and a flourish.
Tell us, does this look like an interview room?
No, because I'm not under arrest. I know my rights.
Course you do, Steve says.
Since you're not under arrest, you've got no right to a solicitor.
You've got the right to leave any time you like, obviously.
I shift my stool back, helpfully, making room for Crowley to go.
I wouldn't recommend it, but if you do, we'll take this to our boss, and then you will be under arrest. And then you can have any solicitor you like.
Crowley starts to get up. When we watch him with interest and don't try to stop him, he changes his mind.
Or, I say. You can do me a quick favour and we'll forget the whole thing. I'll even throw you a bit of a scoop just to show there's no hard feelings.
I'd go with that one, Steve advises him. If it was me, like.
The favour, Crowley says. Most of the pompous puff has leaked out of his voice.
What's the favour?
You've been showing up at way too many of my crime scenes the last while, I say. Who's been tipping you off? Crowley nearly crumples off his bench with relief. He tries to cover by pursing his lips and doing scruples. Me and Steve wait.
I'm not the kind of person who stirs up trouble. That makes Steve snort. Unless it's morally necessary.
It is, of course, Steve says cheerfully. You spill. Conway sorts out whatever beef the lads have with her. Everyone gets to concentrate on catching criminals. Justice is served. Plus, you don't have to waste your time fighting charges. You can keep on fighting the good fight instead. It's morally all tickety-boo.
I'm not going to rat you out to your buddies, I say. You can keep your cosy little relationships going. I just want to know who's fucking me about. Crowley makes a face at hearing language out of a girl, but he's smart enough to keep his gob shut. He taps his lips with one fingertip and leaves another few seconds for his scruples to impress us. Then he sighs.
Detective Roach lets me know when he thinks I might take an interest in one of your cases.
No surprise there. Roach? And who else? After a moment, he says, reluctantly, hates to jeopardize his beautiful new friendship.
Detective Breslin rang me on Sunday morning. He mentioned the Aisling Murray case.
Yeah, we already knew that. Is he the one who gave you my home address? Or was that Roach?
I got it from a contact.
What kind of contact? You can't make me reveal my sources.
I know you people would love to turn this country into a totalitarian. Steve pumps his fist and goes, yes, at the phone.
Sorry, he says. You were saying totalitarian something?
I say, this wasn't a journalistic source, moron. This was someone helping you to help a criminal break into my house.
You think that's protected?
It could be. You don't know what else he told me.
Crowley. You want me to ask them instead?
He shrugs like a teenager in a sulk.
All right, Breslin.
The little fucker. I should have punched him when I had the chance.
How'd you get it out of him?
Oh, please. I didn't put him on the rack. When he rang me about the Aisling Murray case, he told me you had a terrible tendency to dither. I'm only quoting.
Crowley holds up his hands and smirks at me.
He said you could take months to close the most blindingly obvious case. Normally that would be your problem, but this time Detective Breslin was stuck on the case with you. And he didn't want his name associated with that nonsense. He needed pressure put on you to actually do your job. Quoting again. Detective, only quoting. So I came up with a little bit of pressure.
No bad, Armand, Steve says to his phone.
We could hardly think straight we were that pressurised. Am I right, Conway?
Crowley shoots him a suspicious look. And then, when the man claiming to be your father rang me, I say, that's why you were falling over yourself to believe he was actually my dad. Here I thought it was just because the idea of shoving your greasy fingers into my private life gave you such a hard-on you couldn't think straight. But you were figuring, if this guy was legit, then sicking him on me would turn up the pressure another notch, and you'd get a pat on the head and a nice treat from your handler. Am I right? Crowley prisses up his mouth.
The tone you're taking is inappropriate, and it's deliberately inflammatory. I'm under no obligation to. You can stick my tone up your hole. You rang Breslin and drooled down the phone to him about how you could fuck up my personal life till my head was so wrecked I'd sign off on anything. All you needed was my home address. And he couldn't wait to hand it over. Am I missing anything out?
He has his arms folded and he's refusing to look at me, to show me that my behaviour is unacceptable.
If you already know everything, why ask me?
Oh, but I don't know everything. Not yet. Roach has been sicking you on my cases. Breslin did it the once. Who else? He shakes his head. That's all. Crowley, I say warning, you don't get to buy your way out of this by throwing me two names. Spill or the deal's off. Crowley does what's meant to be wounded nobility, but comes out looking like indigestion. I actually know when transparency is important, Detective Conway. And there are plenty of guards who can't say that. Other detectives do contact me. There actually are some who care about the public's right to know. But not about your cases. I can't tell what sends up the sudden wild spurt of anger. The chance that he's lying, or the chance that he's telling the truth. I go in close across the table and I say right into his face, don't you fuck with me. Whoever you're skipping, I will find out, do you get me? And you'll spend the rest of your life looking over your shoulder and wishing you'd gone for a career cleaning the jacks in Supermax. I'm not skipping anyone. Detective Roach and this time Detective Breslin. That's it. It's the fear on Crowley's face that convinces me. He adds bitchily, I'm sure you think you're interesting enough to deserve a mass conspiracy, but apparently not everyone agrees. My head feels strange, weightless. All this time I've been thinking the whole squad's out for my blood. The squad room is a curtain swelling with the enemy army behind it. I'm the lone fighter, lifting her sword and knowing she's going down. Except every time I pull back the curtain, all I find is the same one wanker. The lad's throwing slaggins my way. I took it for granted the edges were sharpened deliberately and smeared with poison, carefully constructed to slice till I dropped. It never occurred to me that it was just slagging, with a bit of extra edge because I don't get on with most of them, and because ever since that first arse slap off Roach, half of them watching, none of them saying a word, I haven't tried. Fleas, hinting to see whether I fancied coming back to undercover. I assumed it was because he knew I was crashing and burning in murder. I never once thought it could be just that we were good together, and he misses me. Steve's spinning his what-ifs and watching them whirl, considering all their glinting angles. I thought, for a few hours in there, I actually believed he was using them to lure me over a cliff edge so he could watch me go splat and wave bye-bye from the top. I'm glad my skin means him and Crowley won't see the blush. I was doing exactly the same thing as Aisling, getting lost so deep inside the story in my head. I couldn't see past its walls to the outside world. I feel those walls shift and start to waver, with a rumble that shakes my bones from the inside out. I feel my face naked to the ice-flavoured air that pours through the cracks and keeps coming. A great shiver is building in my back. Crowley and Steve are both watching me, waiting to see if I'm going to let Crowley off the hook. Steve's game is yelping for attention. Okay, I say. I want to walk out, but I'm not done here. I shove everything else to the back of my mind. Okay, we'll go with that, Crowley says, the fear's vanished. He's straight back into hyena mode. You mentioned having a bit of news for me. Oh yeah, I say. My focus is back. This is going to be fun. Have I got a scoop for you? You're going to love this. Crowley whips out his voice recorder, but I shake my head. Nah. This is non-attributable. It comes from the sources close to the investigation. Got it? Sources close to the investigation. Means cops. I don't want McCann and Breslin thinking Lucy's been talking. He gets pouty, but I sit back and have a watch of Steve jabbing manically at his phone screen. In the end, Crowley sighs and puts the recorder away. I suppose so. Good man, I say, sitting up again. Get a load of this. Aisling Murray, right? Crowley nods, filling up with drool. hoping I'm about to tell him she was raped in creative ways. She was having an affair with a married guy. Crowley's only delighted to settle for that. He does a man of the world head shake.
I knew she was too good to be true. Knew it. Girls who look like that, my God. They think they can get away with anything. Sometimes, oops, so sorry, Your Highness. It doesn't work out like that.
He's already rewriting the story in his head, whizzing through his best euphemisms for home-wrecking nympho who got what she deserved. Steve says,
it gets better. Guess what our fella does for a living?
Crowley pinches his chin and thinks. Well, obviously a girl like that would have liked money. But I'd hazard a guess that she was even more aroused by power. Would I be right? Me and Steve are well impressed. How come you're not doing air job? Steve wants to know.
We could do with that kind of smarts on the squad.
Ah, well. Not everyone's the type who can work for the man, Detective Moran. I think we must be talking about a politician. Let me see.
Crowley steeples his fingers against his lips. He's got the whole story rolling out in his head, ready for ink.
Ashley's job wouldn't have taken her into those circles, so they must have met socially, meaning he's young enough to be out and about.
Even better than that, I say. I have a quick glance around the pub, lean across the table and head Beck and Crowley in. When him and his patchouli reek get close enough for a whisper, he's a cop.
Even better, Steve says, ditching his phone and leaning in beside me. He's a detective.
Even better, I say. He's a murder detective.
Not me, Steve adds. I'm single, thank Jesus.
We both sit back and smile big wide smiles at Crowley. He stares at us, sticky little mind racing while he tries to work out our angle and whether we're bullshitting him.
I can't run that, he says.
I say, you're going to run it.
I can't. I'll be sued. The courier will be sued.
Not if you don't name names, Steve reassures him. There's 2 dozen of us on the squad. All guys except Conway here, and most of them are married. That's, what, 16 or 17 people it could be. You're safe as houses.
I have contacts who will be furious. I'm not going to sabotage my career.
Everyone on Mordor already hates you, man, Steve points out, going back to his game. Except Roach and Breslin. And just to ease your mind, it's not them. So it's not like you're going to burn any bridges.
You'll be a hero, I say. Ireland's bravest investigative journalist, daring to take on the man and strike a blow for truth and transparency. Never even thinking about the risk to himself. It's going to be great.
Think how much hoop you'll get, Steve says.
Crowley throws him a look of disdain. I say, the story runs tomorrow. A married detective, not involved in investigating Ashley Murray's murder, but in a position very close to that investigation, was having an affair with her. If we need you to throw anything else in there at some stage, we'll let you know. And the brass will have no choice. There'll be an internal investigation. It won't find enough for charges any more than we did, but at least McCann won't be prancing back to his marriage and his lifetime murder billet like none of this ever happened. Aisling's getting the job done in the end. I wonder if some part of her realised, in dark glints during the long nights when she couldn't sleep for planning, that this was the only way it could go down. I ask, is that all clear? Crowley's shaking his head, but it's at us and our crudeness and our general inferiority as human beings. We all know he's going to do it.
Great, I say.
I shove my stool back and stand up. Steve kills his game. See you around. And we leave Crowley and Sart to get to work on his brand new scoop. Outside, the air is mild enough to trick you into turning your face to it, looking for warmth. It's only 5 o'clock, but it's dark and the streets are starting to shift into their evening buzz. Clumps of smokers laughing outside the pubs. Girls hurrying home swinging shopping bags to get ready for the night out.
I want to ask you something, I say to Steve. Do you know who pissed in my locker that time?
I never told him about that, but he doesn't pretend it's news. He watches me steadily, hands in his overcoat pockets.
Not for definite. No one's going to talk about that around me.
Breslin said, of course Steve would have heard the stories. Of course Steve would have told me if he'd been on my side. Breslin said a load of stuff. I shut my trap. Steve hears the rest anyway. He says, matter-of-factly,
everyone knows I got here because you put in a word for me. They see us working together. No one's going to try messing with that. They're not tick.
It catches me with a warmth that almost hurts.
Yeah, I say.
No.
Steve says, from what I've walked in on, but the locker was Roach.
How about the poster with my head photoshopped into the gash pick?
Yeah, Roach.
Right, I say. Okay. I turn in a circle, looking up at the city lights, painting the clouds a tricky grey gold.
All the other shy. Not the small stuff, the real shy.
Like I said, I wouldn't know. But I've never heard anything to say anyone else was in on it.
I say, you never told me. That gets a flick of one corner of his mouth.
'Cause you would have listened, yeah?
Steve hanging on his precious gangster story for dear life, building it bigger and fancier and twirlier, waving his arms for me to look. Here I thought he was trying to cheer me up so I wouldn't get him in the lad's bad books. All along he was hoping if he could just come up with a good enough alternative, maybe he could snap me out of convincing myself the whole case, the whole squad, was one great big conspiracy to shaft me.
I can't decide which of us is the bigger spa.
Huh? I say. The air smells tasty and restless. All those places you could spend your evening. All the things waiting to happen inside those beckoning open doors.
Would you look at that?
What?
I just wish I'd copped it earlier, is all.
Steve waits.
I say. We need to talk to the gaffer.
Chapter 18. Me and Steve back in the gaffer's office. It's down the end of a corridor. With the click of the door, the silence closes around us and we're 1,000 miles from the rest of the squad. The layers of tat and clutter close in too. Spider plant, golf trophies, framed crap, stacks of pointless old files, and there's a brand new snow globe holding down a heap of paper on the desk. Souvenir of some grandkid's holiday. In the middle of it all, O'Kelly taking off his reading glasses to look at us. He says,
Breslin was in. He says you've hit a wall with the Aisling Murray case. Time to take a step back. Hope ye catch a break somewhere down the road.
He gets a bang on, gruff. And not exactly delighted with us, but holding back from the bollocking because Breslin told him we've done a good job. For a second there, I could almost believe it's real, and all the rest is their imagination. The rush of fury pulls a sharp breath into me. The gaffer watches us. I say, McCann killed Aisling Murray. Not one muscle of O'Kelly changes. He says,
sit down.
We turn the spare chairs towards his desk and sit. The crisp whirl and click of Steve placing his chair is full up tight with that same fury.
Let's hear it.
We tell him what happened while the darkness thickens at the window. We keep it very clear and very cold. No commentary, just fact stacked neatly on top of fact. The way the gaffer likes his reports. He picks up the shitty snow globe and turns it from angle to angle between his fingers, watching the shavings of plastic snow tumble, and listens. When we're done, he says, still inspecting the snow globe.
How much of that can you prove?
Not enough to put him away, Steve says. He's barely holding down the savage edge of sarcasm. Don't be worrying. It's all grand. Not even enough for a charge.
That's not what I asked.
McCann's connection to the old case is on fire, I say. The anger slicing through my voice too, and I'm not even trying to hide it. Gary O'Rourke and I can both confirm that Aisling was trying to track down the story on her father. The affair's solid. We've got forensics and the best mate's statement. Plus, McCann admitted it. And we've got the best mate's evidence that Aisling was only stringing him along. When it comes to Saturday evening, we've got nothing but Rory Fallon's statement about seeing McCann, which is worth bugger all. McCann's saying nothing. Breslin says McCann found her dead. But no one's going to confirm that on record. O'Kelly's eyes flick up to me.
Breslin said that.
An hour ago. He swivels his chair with a long, low creak to the window. He could be staring out over the courtyard at the slope of cobblestones and the proud, high, windowed rise of the building opposite. The old, solid shapes he has to know by heart, only for the darkness. Steve says, like it's punched its way out of him. He rang you Sunday morning, before you gave us the case. One flicker of the gaffer's eyelids. Except for that, we could think he didn't hear. We were a gift, I say. The perfect stooges. Moran's a newbie. Conway's fighting a bad rep. Easy to point them in the wrong direction. If they come up with something you don't like, easy to twist their arms, make them back off and shut their gobs. Worst comes to worst. Easy to smear them bad enough that no one will listen to a word they say. O'Kelly ought to reef me over for talking to my gaffer like that. He doesn't even turn. The desk lamp slides gold light down the brass desk plaque saying Detective Superintendent G. O'Kelly. After a long time, he says,
Breslin said it was a mate of his.
Neither of us answers. He takes a deep breath and lets it out delicately, the way you do when you're dying of a cough, afraid if you do it wrong you might explode.
5 in the morning, he rang me. He said his friend, one of his best friends, he had called around to his girlfriend that night. Found her in her sitting room, unconscious, bet up.
Pretty sure another boyfriend did it, I said.
So what are you dragging me out of bed for? Call it in. Get the uniforms and the paramedics over there. See you in the morning.
Breslin said he was going to call it in as soon as we hung up. But then he said to me, my friend's got a wife and kids. He can't be linked to this gaffer. It'll wreck his life. We need to keep him out of it. O'Kelly lets out a small, humourless snort of laughter.
I said, don't be giving me that shite about my friend. We all know what that means. But Breslin said no. He swore up and down, it's not me, gaffer. You know me, I don't step out on my missus. I put you on to her. She can tell you I've been with her and the kids all weekend.
A lie that size? From a fella I know the way I know Breslin.
I wouldn't have missed it. I believed him.
He moves. The chair creaks sharply.
I said, your mate says he didn't put a finger on her, just walked in and found the damage done. Do you believe him?
And Breslin said he did, yeah. 100%. 200. 1,000.
He wasn't lying then, either. And Breslin's no idiot.
He's had plenty of practice spotting bullshit stories. There's a second of silence while we all let that lie there.
I asked him, then what are you getting into hysterics about? If your friend did nothing and saw nothing, there's no reason his name should ever come into this. The board will wake up and tell the uniforms who gave her the slaps. They'll pull the fella in. She'll refuse to press charges. Everyone will go home, rinse and repeat a month or two down the line. Your mate's grand. I hope it scared him shitless enough that he'll keep it in his trousers from now on.
The cough breaks through. We wait while O'Kelly pulls a tissue out of his pocket and presses it to his mouth, makes ferocious raving noises to clear his throat. He says,
but Breslin was worried. He said his mate hadn't checked to see was the girl breathing. Too shaken up, too afraid of being snared. He'd just legged it out of there and rung Breslin. They had no way of knowing how long she'd been lying there. If she was dead, then his mate was fucked. He'd be dragged in, dragged through the muck, lose everything. All because he stuck his Mickey in the wrong hole.
The prickle of alert lifts Steve's head at the same moment as mine. Breslin told us McCann checked and Aisling was dead, meaning he would have done no good by calling it in. So he wasn't a bad guy for leaving her bleeding on the floor. Both versions are bullshit anyway, but I'd love to know why he served O'Kelly a different flavour from us. O'Kelly either hasn't noticed or doesn't want to.
I said, do you want something? What is it? Breslin said, if she's dead, I need to be on the case. I'm not asking to be in charge. I just want to be around so I can see what's going on. Make sure my mate doesn't get dragged in if there's no need. If it's all cut and dried, there's no reason to ruin his life. If he's needed, I'll make sure he comes forward, I swear. He said, I've got 13 years of credit, Gaffer. I'm calling it in now.
The corner of O'Kelly's mouth twists as he remembers.
Breslin's not the genius he thinks he is, but he's a good man. He's never let me down. Never asked me for a favour bigger than a plum slop for his holidays. If he wanted to cash in his chips on this one. His shoulders lift, fall again heavily. In the end, I said, all right. I told him to watch himself and watch his mate. I was going to be all over this one. And if I got any hints that anything was off, then he was gone and his pal was coming in for the chats. He said, no problem. No problem at all. He told me how much he appreciated it and how much he owed me and a bit more arse licking that I didn't take much notice of. And then he went off to call it in. Another story.
None of the rest were true straight through. Not one. Victims, witnesses, killers, D's, all frantically spinning stories to keep the world the way they want it. Dragging them over our heads, stuffing them down our throats, and now our gaffer. I say, I haven't talked in so long that my voice comes out rough and patchy, dried out by the heating.
You knew who the mate was.
O'Kelly's eyes moved to my face. They stayed there like I make him too tired to look away.
You tell me, Conway, when you started smelling something rotten, did you straight away think, ah, I know, must have been one of my own squad? The weight of his voice, my own squad, falls on me like the swaying weight of deep water.
28 years O'Kelly's been on murder. Since me and Steve were sticky-faced kids pointing finger guns at our pals. When he says my own squad, it means things I used to dream I'd understand someday. I say, no.
And when you should have known, did you think it then?
No.
No.
His head turns back to the window.
Nor did I, but I wondered. I didn't like that. I thought less of myself for it. Still do. But there it was. That's why I gave you the case. I needed to know. And you were the only ones who wouldn't drop it like a hot potato if Breslin wanted you to.
And we waded right in and did his dirty work for him. Maybe he expects us to be grateful for the vote of confidence. I say,
now you know.
You're positive. You'd bet your lives on it.
Steve says,
he did it.
O'Kelly nods a few times.
Right, he says quietly to himself, not to us. Right.
I wait for it, just for kicks. I try to guess which he'll whip out first. The fatherly wisdom, the squad loyalty, the man-to-man chat, the guilt trip, the bribes, the threats. I hope Steve's got no plans for this evening because it could take a while before it sinks into the gaffer's head that he's getting nowhere. While I'm at it, I try to decide whether we should tell him it's already too late so we can enjoy the look on the bollocks' face or whether we should play it safe and let him find out in the morning along with everyone else when the courier comes out. He swivels his chair to his desk and picks up the phone. His finger on the buttons is clumsier than it should be. His knuckles are swollen stiff. When someone answers, he says,
"McCann, I need you in my office," and hangs up.
His eyes fall on us for a moment in passing.
"You can stay," he says. "As long as you act like adults. You get bitchy, you're out."
Then he goes back to looking out the window at whatever it is he sees out there. Me and Steve glance at each other just once. Steve's face is quick and wary, all the angles sharpened. He doesn't have a handle on where this is going either, and he doesn't like that any more than I do. We swap a tiny nod, "Stay, steady." Then we sit still, listening to the faint singing hiss of the radiators and the slow rasp of O'Kelly's breathing, and we wait for McCann to come. The knock at the door snaps the silence.
"Come,"
O'Kelly says, turning his chair, and there's McCann in the doorway, jacket sagging, eyes sunk deep. Two beats, one look at the gaffer, one at us. And he understands. His shoulders shift and roll forward as he gets ready for the fight.
"Morin," O'Kelly says. "Give McCann a chair."
I stand up with Steve and we move to the side against the wall. For a second, it looks like McCann's going to stay standing, but then he yanks Steve's chair farther from us and sits down, legs wide, feet braced, chin forward. O'Kelly says,
"You should have told me."
A fast, raw flush springs up on McCann's cheekbones. He opens his mouth to spew out a flood of reasons, excuses, justifications, whatever. Then he shuts it again.
"How long have I been your gaffer?"
After a moment, McCann says,
11 years. "Any complaints?"
McCann shakes his head.
"Have I had your back along the way? Or have I hung you out to dry when things got tough?"
"Had my back. Always." O'Kelly nods. He says,
"A civilian who's fucked up. He tries to hide it from his boss. A D? In trouble? He goes to his gaffer."
McCann can't look at him. The flush deepens.
"I should have. Straight away. I know that."
O'Kelly waits.
"Sorry." "Okay,"
the gaffer says. He gives McCann the curt nod that means you're off the hook. Don't fuck up again.
"We're talking now anyway. And I want to know what in holy hell has been going on here. These two."
He jerks his chin at me and Steve.
"They're trying to tell me you went pussy blind. Ashley Murray was out to fuck you over. You were thinking with your Mickey. The whole thing went to shite. Is that true? This whole 5-star clusterfuck. It's all because you weren't getting enough blood flow to the brain."
McCann's jaw moves. He doesn't like that.
"Because I know you. Or anyway, I thought I did. And I say it's bollocks. These two have come up with some story they like, and they're making everything they get fit the story."
It tracks cold right down into my stomach, like swallowed ice. The story we told him, the true one. It'll never leave this room. By the time we walk out, O'Kelly and McCann between them will have sliced it to pieces and sewn it up into something unrecognisable to set loose into the outside world. I knew it was coming, but it still hits home.
"Fact is, everything they've got plays a couple of different ways."
One fast glance from McCann. O'Kelly holds up a thumb.
"The photos of your notes. It's a safe bet Ashlyn was going to take those to your wife, but all that says is she wanted you for herself. Nothing to say why."
Thumb and finger.
"That fairy tale yoke she left for her mate. That just says she felt trapped, and I don't blame her. You're a fucking idiot, putting the girl in that situation. Like she wanted to spend the rest of her life being your bit in the side. And she was angry with you. Wanted to turn the table so you couldn't get away from her."
A quick double blink from McCann. This is reaching him. Any second now he'll be jumping on board with whatever O'Kelly's got planned. Another finger. Rory Fallon.
Aisling could have been trying to get you out of her head. She had enough sense to know the two of ye were a bad idea all round.
McCann's looking at him now, the drowning man hope struggling on his face is terrible.
Maybe this is just me doing my own wishful thinking. I don't want to believe you'd make a mess like this one, drag the whole squad into it, just for the sake of a ride. For you to fuck up this badly, then you and Aisling, that had to be the real thing.
Shame mixed in with hope.
We can't ask Aisling what was going on in her head. You're the only other person who was there. If anyone knows, it's you. So you tell me, McCann. Was it the real thing? Or are we all sitting here because you fancied a fuck?
The clench of anger in his voice pulled it out of McCann.
It was real. I'm not that bloody stupid.
Real,
the gaffer says, and waits for more.
Maybe Aisling did go into it wanting to fuck me over.
Probably. Maybe she ended the same way. That mate of hers persuaded her, or I don't know. But there was a while in there.
McCann rubs his eyes. In the merciless light they look red and sore, like he's got an infection starting. He says,
I couldn't believe it was happening. To me.
I thought I knew the rest of my life like it had already happened. All the decisions that make a difference, I'd made them before I was 25. The job, the wife, the neighbourhood, having kids. All that was left was for me to sit there and watch them play out. No twists left, no surprises.
He lifts his head to look over at me and Steve.
You won't get it now. You too. You're still young enough that anything could happen. But you'll find out.
It's like being in a film. One of those third-rate ones where by halfway through you know exactly where it's headed. Every step. You can't remember why you're even bothering to watch the rest. Because it's there. Just because there's nothing else to do. And then he blinks hard, like that might clear his eyes.
And all of a sudden, someone lifts you right out of it and drops you into a different film. Different music, different colours. She was brighter. Always bright colours, and anything could happen.
Steve says, so what you told us about just liking our company, that was bollocks.
You knew from the start that this was something special.
McCann shakes his head.
Nah, I didn't think that way. Not at first. I loved being with her. Nothing more than that. I never thought of doing more than that. Just seeing her listen to my stories like they mattered. It reminded me of how I used to feel about the job way back when.
The look on her face. When I pulled a good case, I used to feel like that. Like what I did changed things. I risk a glance at the gaffer. His face is steady. The shadows of wrinkles and eye sockets turn it unreadable.
Okay, Steve says, keeping the scepticism level well below bitchy. So how did that change?
One night, McCann says.
He brushes a hand over his cheek like something fine and cobwebby is catching at him.
One night, August, Aisling said some guy had chatted her up at her evening class. Just in passing, she mentioned it. She wasn't into him. She turned him down. But that was when it hit me. A girl like that? Of course she's going to want a fella. Not just someone for picnics and talk. A man who loves her. A man in her bed. Hit me like a ton of bricks. Because I knew once she got him, I'd be gone.
She made him think it was his idea, Lucy said. She did a good job of it.
And then I thought, why not me? Why not? We were loving each other's company, couldn't get enough. There was chemistry there. Even I could tell that. The way she looked at me. The way her breathing went when we accidentally got close. There was something.
A sharp glance at me and Steve. That faint, stinging red has come up on his cheekbones again.
Probably it sounds pathetic to you.
Just a middle-aged fool head over heels for some young one. Oldest story in the world. You weren't there.
Every murderer says that to us sooner or later. You weren't there. You don't understand. There's a small, dry chip of silence while no one points that out. I say, it was that easy. You said, hey, let's give it a go, and Aisling said, sure, why not? McCann shakes his head heavily.
I don't know how I made it happen. You two, you keep talking like she hunted me down, but it wasn't. She didn't want to be some homewrecker. It took me a while to convince her she was doing no harm that hadn't been done years ago. When we finally... That was when I realised she honest to God cared about me. A quick involuntary catch of breath. That blew me away. Just blew me away. The wonder in his voice. He sounds like a teenager, lifting with joy and amazement. He sounds so tender you could bruise him with one wrong touch. Time after time it's left me gobsmacked. How people will tell you things they should keep locked inside for life. How ferociously they need the story to be out in the air, in the world, to exist somewhere outside their own heads. He says, it was real. All that shite you've got, that means nothing. One time I fell, getting over a wall, scraped up my knee. Aisling knelt down in front of me and washed it, so gentle. You'd think she'd have done that if she only hated my guts. Maybe she did, some of the time. But she loved me as well. People are complicated. She was more complicated than I realised.
He's giving me and Steve a stare that's a challenge. No takers. The whole thing is pure double-dipped fantasy, but the last thing we want to do is take it apart. Me and Steve scrabbling so hard to pull the true story out of the tangle. We forgot the false ones come with their own ferocious, double-edged power. The gaffer nods.
I would have put money on that. Nice to know I'm not losing the bit I have.
He resettles himself in his chair, adjusts his waistband over his belly.
Now we've got that cleared up, he says. Let's talk about Saturday night.
McCann opens his mouth, but O'Kelly lifts a hand.
No, hang on. That's not what I'm asking you.
McCann shuts up.
Breslin told these two you found Aisling dead. But he told me that you, that his mate, I mean, didn't even check for a pulse. Why?
A shake of McCann's head, baffled and wary. This isn't what he was expecting. Not what I was expecting either. I'm not sure anymore that I have the foggiest clue what the gaffer is at.
He wanted me thinking the mate was a civilian, is why. So he said the mate panicked and did a runner, the way a civilian would. The way no D would ever.
O'Kelly shoots a sharp glance at McCann under his eyebrows.
You happy with that?
A humourless twist of McCann's mouth.
Not happy with any of this.
You shouldn't be.
You let Breslin paint you as a civilian, to keep you out of hassle with your gaffer. How does that sit with you?
McCann's jaw moves.
Not great. Good. Because it's not sitting great with me either.
O'Kelly leaves that for a moment, but McCann's got nothing to add.
And then a minute ago, you said Aisling made you feel the way you used to feel on a good case. Like what you did mattered.
Nod.
Used to feel, he said. Meaning, not anymore.
McCann's eyes are on the floor.
Since when?
I don't know. A couple of years back.
What happened?
O'Kelly's leaning forward, elbows on the desk, as close as he can get. Me and Steve aren't moving. We're not even in the room. This is between McCann and O'Kelly. McCann says,
it wasn't the job. It was me. What I said before, somewhere in there, it started feeling like everything I'd ever do was already set in stone. Middle of a big interview.
Out of nowhere, I get this feeling like my mouth was moving by itself. Like I was reading off a script and there was no way I could change it. It had hit me that it didn't matter who was sitting in my seat, asking the questions. The ending would be the same if it was me, Winters or Gorman, anyone. Felt like I was vanishing. It wasn't that I stopped seeing myself as a D. I stopped seeing myself at all. The gaffer says heavily.
I should have spotted that.
McCann says urgently. It never made a difference on the job, gaffer. I never slacked. No matter what, I gave it 100%.
I know.
O'Kelly leans back in his chair, runs a hand over his mouth.
What were you planning? Transfer off the squad? Hold out till you had your 30 and retire?
McCann's face upturned to him like a kid's begging. No, gaffer, no. I thought midlife crisis. I'd work through it. Come out the other side. Get my head back. I wasn't going anywhere. Here till they drag me out.
O'Kelly says, not brutal, just quiet and simple.
That's out now.
McCann bites down on his lip.
I can't have you on the squad.
After a long time, the smallest slice of a nod.
And I can't palm you off on some other squad. Not knowing what I do.
That nod again.
And the story's going to come out one way or another. Aisling's mate. We can keep her quiet for a while, but sooner or later she'll cop that the case is going nowhere. And she'll find herself a journal to talk to.
O'Kelly doesn't look at me and Steve, doesn't act like he even knows we're there. But I wonder.
And we'll have the Garda ombudsman jumping down our throats. There'll be two inquiries, minimum. Ours and theirs. Breslin'll be for the chop.
That pulls a quick in-breath through McCann's nose, jerks his head back.
What do you expect, withholding evidence and there's that phone call to Stony Batter to prove it? He'd be lucky if he's not up on charges.
Gaffer, McCann says, the raw desperation gashing his voice open. I can't look at him. It's not Breslin's fault. He did nothing. Only stood by me, please.
I won't be able to do anything for Breslin, McCann. And for the chop too.
No self-pity in O'Kelly's voice. These are facts. No different from fingerprint results or alibi times.
Unless I put in my papers before the investigation finishes up. In which case, I won't be around to give Breslin a dig out.
Christ, McCann says, barely above a whisper. Oh, Christ, gaffer. I'm sorry.
No. Don't be getting maudlin on me. It's done now.
O'Kelly's face across the desk, all unmovable grooves and crevices, like something carved a long time ago to send a message I can't read.
You've got a choice. You can go out like a scumbag. Or you can be a D one more time.
The silence goes on for so long. The office has changed, shifted. The same way the cosy interview room did. Crayon drawings, tiny flakes stirring in the snow globe. Thin skin stretched over clean bones and clacking teeth. McCann says quietly,
Saturday evening, after dinner. I told my wife I was going for a pint and I headed over to Aisling's house. I went in through the kitchen, saw the dinner cooking. But I didn't think anything of it. There was music playing, dancey stuff. Aisling didn't hear me come in. I went out into the sitting room calling her. Quiet, like always, so the neighbours wouldn't hear. And I saw the table, except for two. Wine glasses. Candle. I thought it was for us. Should have known. I'm never over to her on Saturdays. Mostly my wife wants to go out to a restaurant. Only that evening she had a headache. No way Aisling would have guessed I was coming. But all I could think about was seeing her.
I risk a flash of sideways glance at Steve and meet him risking one at me, wide-eyed. We're the only ones gobsmacked here. McCann's voice doesn't even hold a flicker of surprise at what he's doing. The moment he walked into this room, he knew what O'Kelly would want from him. Breslin knew too. That's why they didn't come to the gaffer with a version that had McCann in it. Beg him to thin blue line it all the way. Me and Steve were the only fools who didn't get it. And then she came out of the bedroom, McCann says. Bright blue dress. Beautiful. Winter evening like that. Nothing but grey and damp and then this blue that'd light up your whole head. Her hair down. She knew I loved it like that. Putting an earring in one ear, I went to go to her. His hands come up, sketching the offer of an embrace. Aisling. She jumped a mile. Then she saw it was me. I expected her to laugh and kiss me. But the face on her, horrified, like I was an intruder. That was when I started to cop. It wasn't me she was waiting for. She put up her hands to stop me touching her. And she said, "You need to go." He's breathing hard, the rush of disbelief hitting him all over again. I couldn't wrap my head. I asked her, I said, "What? What are you doing? What are you on about?" But she just kept pointing at the back door, telling me to go. I was begging her. Don't even know what I was saying. I said, "What's happened? Just Wednesday night, we were 3 days ago. Have you had enough of me going home to my wife? Am I not spending enough time with you? I'll end it with my wife tonight. I'll move in. Do anything." "Was there something someone said about me? Did your mate Lucy? I'll explain. Let me..." But she was just shaking her head. "No, not that. No, no, just go." She was trying to move me towards the kitchen, herding me, only I wouldn't. Or I couldn't. I said, stupid, standing there, couldn't keep up. I said, "Are we done? Does this mean we're done?" And Aisling, she stopped like she'd never thought of that, startled. And then she said, "Well, yes, I suppose it does." There's no way I'd risk a glance at Steve now. Neither of us is breathing. "It felt like a joke," McCann says. "I was waiting for the punchline. Her face. She meant it." I said, "All I could say..." "Why?" She said, "Go home." I said, "Tell me why and I'll go. Whatever it is, just tell me. I can't live wondering." She looked at me and she laughed. Aisling's got a lovely laugh. Sweet little giggle. But this wasn't... This was something different. Great, wild laugh. Huge. She sounded... McCann's throat moves as he hears that laugh again, growing and growing to fill his head unstoppable. She sounded happy. The happiest I'd ever heard her. And then she said, "You keep on wondering, now fuck off." He stops talking. O'Kelly says, "And?" McCann says, "And I hit her." Me and Steve, we went at McCann by ripping away what he believed most about his life, blowing it up in front of his eyes, and hoping there'd be too little of him left to hold out against us. Just like Aisling had been planning. But when we took as much of McCann as we could, shredded him into the last thing he ever wanted to be, we left him with no comment. O'Kelly offered McCann a way back to who he was. McCann's taken it. He says,
"It wasn't murder, Gaffer. It was manslaughter. I never meant her to die."
The gaffer says,
"I know. It never came to me that she might. Not till after. I know."
I'm taking in a breath to say it. Cooper's report. McCann is no bodybuilder, He landed that punch when Aisling was down, head on the stone fireplace. O'Kelly hears the breath. His eyes flick to me and he waits for what I'm going to say. His face still hasn't changed, only the eyes, moving in shadow, look alive. I shut my mouth. The gaffer's eyes go back to McCann. He says,
"We need this on record. You understand that?"
McCann nods. He keeps nodding for a long time. O'Kelly leans his hands on the desk to stand up.
"Time to go," he says.
McCann's face turns up to him quickly.
"I'll do it,"
the gaffer says, steadying like a surgeon, promising to cut it out himself, not to let the med students touch the scalpel. McCann says,
"Maura, I'll go see her, soon as we're done."
McCann nods again. He stands up, stays by the chair, arms hanging at his sides, waiting to be told where to go next. The gaffer tugs down his jacket carefully, like he's got somewhere important to be. He switches off the desk lamp and looks around his office, absently touching his pockets. His eyes fall on me and Steve like he forgot we were there.
"Go home," he says.
We don't talk. Down the long, silent corridor, the padding of our feet on the carpet like muffled heartbeats. Down the stairs, through the cold draught that fidgets in the stairwell, to the locker room, coats on, satchels on shoulders, locker doors closing. Back upstairs, the smiles and the nods and the few words with Bernadette at reception, stuffing tissue packets and throat lozenges into her bag, ready to go home. And outside, to the wide, sharp blast of city smell and cold. The great courtyard, the floodlights, the civil servants scurrying home. It all looks strange. Small, stark paper things far away. A big salve does that to you. Leaves the world scoured dawn white. Sand white. Empty except for the salve smooth and heavy as a deep dived rock in your hand. Only it's more than that this time. The cobblestones feel wrong under my feet. Thin skins of stone over bottomless fog. The squad I've spent the last 2 years hating. The mob of sniggering fucktards backstabbing the solo warrior while she gallantly fought her doomed battle. That's gone. Peeled away like a smeared film that was stuck down hard over the real thing. The squad I would have chopped off an arm to join. The shining line of ass-kicking superheroes that went a long time ago. What's left underneath is smaller than either of those, quieter and more complicated, done in finer detail. Roach begging for a punch in the gob, which is high on my to-do list. The lads, each of them deep in his own mix of dodgy alibis and messy fibre evidence and the baby's chicken pox, occasionally glancing up to roll their eyes at Roach's bullshit or mine. The gaffer. It occurs to me that just maybe the gaffer throws the odd domestic our way, not because they piss me off, but because they have a good clearance rate and he wants our stats solid. Or maybe even simpler, because he knows we'll work the hell out of them. All of them. And Steve. And me. We stand in the courtyard, hands in our pockets, shoulders up against the cold. We're not sure where to go from here. There's no rule book, no ritual to tell us what comes after a day like this one. Above us, the murder windows are lit and alert, ready for whatever tonight's got in store. Somewhere up there, O'Kelly and McCann are in the interview room, heads bent close, talking low and steady. Breslin is alone in the observation room, watching through the slow swell and ebb of his breath on the glass, not moving. Steve says, "He was looking after us." He means the gaffer, sending us home. "I know," I say. It'll be O'Kelly's name on McCann's statement sheet. O'Kelly's name on the book of evidence that goes to the prosecutor.
When we walk into the squad room tomorrow, we won't be hissed out of it. Breslin will hate our guts as long as he lives. The rest of them will watch O'Kelly walking out the building shoulder to shoulder with McCann to take him to booking and understand. Steve catches a sudden deep breath, blows it out again.
God, he says,
and there's a shake in his voice that he doesn't bother trying to hide.
What a day.
Look on the bright side. We're never going to have a worse week than this one. That pulls a helpless bark of laughter out of him.
You never know. We could get lucky. The commissioner could get coked up and strangle a hooker. Fuck that. Someone else can work it. Just Quigley's speed.
Steve laughs again, but it's gone fast.
The reason we didn't see it from the start, he says, is because we were thinking like cops, both of us.
He leaves it hanging there, like a question. He knows.
Here I was, so sure I was some secret agent level closed book, keeping my big plan all to myself.
I watch our breath spread and fade on the air.
So?
Steve says, squinting up at a shadow crossing one of the windows.
You putting in your papers?
I can practically see the might bees bobbing like marsh lights over the cobblestones, skimming past the high windows, tricky and beckoning. Me, in a suit that makes this one look like a bin liner, striding through Harrods after some Saudi princess. One eye on her, and the other on everything else. Me, stretching out my legs in business class, checking exit routes in the hushed corridors of 24-carat hotels, lounging beside a blinding blue sea with a cocktail in one hand and the other on the gun in my beach bag. All the might have beens whirling in and out among the bars of the gate and gone.
Nah, I say. I hate paperwork.
I swear Steve's head falls back with relief.
Jesus, he says. I was worried.
I never saw that one coming.
Yeah?
His face turns towards me. He's as startled as I am.
Course, what did you think?
Don't know. Never thought about it.
Not once.
And I should have. For a second I see Breslin in the interview room, practically lifting off his feet with fury. There's no fucking way he did this. Breslin in his dark sitting room before dawn, muffling his voice on the phone to Stony Batter Station.
Sorry, I say. I've made a bleeding tosser of myself the last while. A lot of ways.
Steve doesn't even try to deny that.
You're all right. We've all done it. I'm not planning on doing it again. That'll be nice.
Fuck off, you. The cobblestones have lost that misty feel. They're centuries worth of solid again. And the cold air hits my lungs like caffeine. I need to ring Crowley, tell him he's off the hook for the article. Make sure he knows he still owes me a big one and I'm going to collect. I need to ring my ma and tell her about last night, whether I want to or not. Maybe it'll give the pair of us a laugh. Maybe Fleas will email me tomorrow when he sees the headlines.
Hiya, Rach. Saw your news. Delighted everything's working out for you. Have to meet up to celebrate. Kiss.
Maybe at the weekend I'll text Lisa and the rest of my mates, see if they're about. You know what I need? I need a pint.
Brogan's?
Steve hitches his satchel up his shoulder.
You're buying. You still owe me for Rory not crying.
What are you on about? He bawled his eyes.
I thought you were done being a tosser.
Nice try. Doesn't mean I'm going to be a pushover.
Ah, good. Because I was dead worried about that.
I take one more look up at the rest of my life. Waiting for me inside those neat, sturdy squares of gold light. Then we start off across the courtyard, arguing, to get a few pints and a few hours kip before it's time to head back and find out what's in there.
This is Hilda Fay. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Trespasser by Tana French. This programme was directed by Ali Mourden and Deborah Pierce. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2016 by Tana French. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.